Regardless of where you end up, understanding developmental stages is very helpful. And at the very least, you need to have a good understanding for the RD exam. I've been a supervisory RD for many years. Some interns would come through and loved working in pediatrics, while others couldn't wait for the rotation to end. And that's okay. I always tell my interns they don't have to love every rotation. It'd be hypocritical of me because I certainly didn't love every rotation when I was in my internship. But it's a good idea, especially since the community is so small, to put your best foot forward and have a good attitude. Whether you love the rotations or not, you have to know developmental stages. The specific nutrition recommendations, of course, vary depending on the age group you're seeing, but having a starting point, a base of knowledge of what to expect with each stage of life will help you. And it helps make you a more well-rounded dietitian. I'm Jana Nickel, and this is the RD Exam Made Easy podcast. I love this topic so much. I hope if you get any questions on the exam that cover developmental stages, that this podcast will help you pass those questions, because that's why you're here, to learn and pass the exam. But more than that, there are some things to keep in mind in each stage that will make you a much better clinician, regardless of where you end up working. Because chances are you'll come across people of different ages, different generations, different stages that will need your help, or at the very least, you can have a conversation with them and learn something new. I've also had interns who struggle with this because they might not have had experience working with children, for example, or maybe haven't spent much time with kids. So it can be a little hard when you start working with that population. And the same thing for teenagers and the elderly. So it's a really good idea to be familiar with this because there's some key things to keep in mind at each stage of life. So before we get started, it's time for a few shout-outs, which is one of my favorite things to do. And I have three shout-outs. So first, I want to congratulate Stephanie Sandoval. She passed the RD exam. I'm so excited and happy for her. She's starting her career in a clinical position, and I couldn't be happier. So congratulations, Stephanie. You did it, and I'm so proud of you. I also want to give a shout out to Jennifer Strickland, who just passed the RD exam. She found the podcast easy to listen to, which is really heartwarming to me. So thank you, Jennifer, because that's my goal. And lastly, Mary Pickler just passed the RD exam. The stories shared on the podcast really resonated with her. I always learn best from stories, so that's what I wanted for this podcast. And it's so nice to hear that it resonates with others too. Congratulations to the three of you. I'm so proud of you. It's a huge accomplishment. I remember feeling so much lighter when I walked out and had passed the exam. So I know how it feels. And I'm so happy that you have that feeling now too. Welcome to the RD community. So it just makes sense to start with infancy. So let's go over the developmental stage of infancy. And I wanted to start by saying the term neonate is for newborns who are in the first month of life. I'm not going to review anything specific about NICU, which is what we tend to associate the term neonate with, because the NICU is the neonatal ICU. But I do want to go over this stage of life because it's important. But just keep in mind that the NICU is a whole topic. It's a whole specialty, and there's so much to talk about that we just don't have time for that today. And for the sake of the RD exam, you don't need to know everything about it because remember, it's an entry-level exam. So for the sake of this episode, I'm going to talk about newborns that are healthy and newborns that do not need specialized critical care support, which is what you tend to see when you're working in the NICU. So eating is super important, especially at this stage because they're growing. And when babies are born, they should eat within the first few minutes after birth. If the baby's going to be breastfed, then breastfeeding should be initiated immediately, if possible. This can be promoted by placing the baby on the chest, skin to skin, right after birth, and giving the baby the opportunity to latch and breastfeed. Babies have a really small window of awake time after they're born before they go into a deep sleep. It's exhausting to be born. All the squeezing that happens during labor with the contractions, it's a lot for them, which is why feeding the baby in that small window of awake period after birth is recommended. The first milk that's available during breastfeeding is called colostrum. It's a thick yellow substance and it has protein. It's also full of antibodies and it helps protect the gut from pathogens. It almost serves as a protective seal to the gut. When babies are born, there's nothing in their GI tract, and the colostrum helps seal off any gaps and serves as a form of protection to stop pathogens from entering the bloodstream. As the baby continues to breastfeed, the milk changes from colostrum to mature milk. If breast milk is not available, then the baby will need to be fed infant formula. As a dietitian, if you work with infants, you want to make sure that parents and caretakers are mixing the infant formula properly and that they're following the mixing instructions. If the formula is not prepared according to the instructions or per a healthcare provider's guidance, it can throw off the electrolytes, such as sodium. And I've seen babies admitted with hyponatremia due to inaccurate formula preparation, so it's something that we really want to reinforce. And keep in mind that when I said, or per healthcare provider's guidance, some babies might need to have a more concentrated formula because of maybe health conditions or they need to grow. They're not growing as much as we would like. So there are some cases where they might need to have some modifications to the formula, but it should be done by a healthcare provider, not by the parents making the decision on their own without that guidance. So it's really good too, as the dietitian, to ask parents how they're mixing the formula when you see them so that you're making sure that it is being mixed properly. The recommendation is to exclusively breastfeed until 6 months of age. And once the infant is 6 months old, they need to be started on solids because breast milk no longer can meet all of their nutritional needs. There's different ways of introducing solids, and I'm not going to go into those different methods or strategies, but I want to emphasize that the infant should be able to hold their head up and they should be able to sit up in a chair before starting solids. So if the baby has low tone or there's some other medical conditions affecting the baby, it'll change the way feeding is progressed. Like I said, this episode, you're learning about feeding and developmental stages of healthy individuals and people who tend to meet milestones and progress through the life cycle without any major challenges or health conditions. I spoke about breastfeeding and breast milk more in episode 3, so if you want more of a thorough review, I recommend you listen to that episode. But to summarize, breast milk is not as high in iron as iron-fortified infant formula, so this should be considered when starting solids. The most common food to start is iron-fortified infant cereal. Meats are high in protein and iron too, so that's another option. And as the baby gets teeth and learns how to use their little pinchers to pick up food, you can add more finger foods. And something we should encourage is for babies to explore and play with their food. It helps them learn about the food and it takes away the uncertainty of being given something new. Because anytime something new is placed in front of you, even as an adult, it might give you pause or make you wonder what that is. And babies are no different. Sometimes they need to be seen something more often, and playing with food is amazing at that age because it helps them learn more about the food and what's in front of them. So remember, everything is new in their world and food is no different. When it comes to weight, generally speaking, infants double their birth weight by 6 months and they triple their birth weight by 1 year. So that's pretty much infancy. I want to say I really find pediatrics fun and a good learning experience, And I felt that it really helped me understand mechanisms behind many processes in the body when I worked in pediatrics. It's a great specialty. And one of the things that's challenging with pediatrics is that childhood is a big range. So I started with infancy, but pediatrics actually covers all ages up until adulthood. And so much happens during childhood, and then there's adolescence before we progress in life to be adults. Infants are different than toddlers. They're different than preschool kids and adolescents. It's a wide range, and a lot happens during these years. So I'm going to move on from infancy and talk about toddlers, because that's a whole other age and a lot happens during toddlerhood. So toddlerhood essentially starts when the child begins to walk. They're super curious. They explore their world. They love colors and things that make noise. And they also can be uncertain about new foods. Toddlers may need to be given a food item many times before they'll try it. They should explore their food by playing with it too, just like infancy. And they should feel textures. They should smell different smells. Licking and squeezing the food is a great way to explore new foods. This is when they're going to learn to also throw their food. It falls. It does cool things. They learn a little bit about gravity and how cool it is. And then there's some toddlers who aren't as willing to explore new foods. So you never know what you're dealing with, and there are some strategies that can help. Keep in mind that toddlers look for reactions from their caretakers. It gives them more information about their world and behavior. And they're working on their oral motor skills during this stage. They learn things like how to hold a spoon or a cup and how to acknowledge when they're hungry and full. Toddlers should be encouraged to feed themselves so that they can listen to their bodies and be intuitive of their needs and if they need more food or not. Textured foods, like I mentioned already, should be added at this age. Remember that toddlers have increased needs because they're on the move. So this is when they start to take off. But they still have small stomachs, so frequent eating and frequent snacks are needed at this age. They snack often, and that helps make sure they get enough nutrition and calories throughout the day. I remember when I was younger, I started babysitting, and choking was my biggest fear. And it's progressed all throughout adulthood. And as a parent, choking, especially in young children, is concerning. And it's something that we have to be aware of when working with toddlers. So they should be sitting at the table when they're eating and not running around or playing. And certain foods should not be given to toddlers, things like whole grapes that can block their airway, or other things that don't have holes, like Cheerios are great because there's a hole in the middle, so that can help air pass. So it's just something to also be aware of. And also toys in the house. So certain toys are dangerous for toddlers, and if they put it in their mouth, it can cause them to choke. So another thing to kind of start baby-proofing the house and making sure that things are safe for toddlers is super important at this age. And also keep in mind that fruits and vegetables are often lacking at this age, so parents and caregivers might need to be creative. And as a dietitian, if you work with toddlers and kids, creativity goes a long way. So if you're creative as a dietitian working with this age group, parents are going to love coming to see you because you're going to have so many cool ideas that will help them. Most parents are willing to go home and try anything, especially if they're struggling to get their kid to eat, because parents worry about kids eating and they want their kids to be healthy and have good nutrition. So parents love cool ideas to help them be creative at home to get their kids to eat more. So let's move on to preschoolers. Just like toddlers, preschoolers also need snacks and smaller meals. This is also when it's a good time to reinforce the division of responsibility. Ellen Satter has done some incredible work in this area. This is where the parent or caretaker decides what and where the child will eat, and the child determines how much they'll eat and what they're willing to eat from what's being offered. So the parent may decide to make sausage, eggs, pancakes, and fruit for breakfast. They're going to eat at home, and everyone will be eating at the kitchen table. The child determines what they're going to eat from the foods being offered and how much of the foods being offered they're willing to eat. This approach continues to expose children to foods even if they don't want those foods, and it also encourages the child to pay attention to their hunger and satiety cues. This is also the stage where kids' diets, the foods they eat, they're representative of the foods their parents eat, because kids eat what's being presented and available to them at home. Something to keep in mind at this age is to monitor milk, because it's really important, but they can be at risk of getting anemia because of the amount of milk some preschoolers will drink. They fill their tummies with milk instead of foods that are high in iron, such as meat, beans, and legumes. And also remember that calcium competes with iron for absorption. Milk or dairy alternatives are still important at this age, but the goal is to not overconsume dairy products, because anemia is a popular topic and it just might pop up on the exam. So be aware of the causes of anemia and the risk factors, such as a diet that's limited in iron-rich foods or consuming too much dairy over iron-rich foods and filling up on dairy foods, which then leads to decreased intake of other food sources. So let's talk a little about school-aged kids. This age group is highly influenced by their peers when it comes to the foods they're eating, and honestly, most other things. Their peers affect their attitudes toward foods and food choices. They also have influence on the things they like, such as clothes and activities, pretty much everything. When it comes to food, there's a little less control over the foods kids consume at this age. They tend to eat more sugar and fat at this age from beverages and desserts, but they also tend to eat more variety than toddlers and preschoolers, so that's a good thing. During this stage, the nutrient needs decrease because they're not in a rapid stage of growth. And just remember, a lot of things influence food at this age. For example, parents' eating habits again, the types of foods provided, the environment meals are eaten, and the way foods are introduced. Also, taste buds change and develop at this age. And something to keep in mind, a fun fact, zinc influences taste. So if you're suspicious that somebody's having a hard time with taste or you're dealing with a really picky eater, zinc is a nutrient to kind of keep an eye on, because that might be affecting their taste or their ability to try and be interested in new foods. Kids in school often get sick, especially if they weren't in daycare, because they're exposed to all the germs and bugs that are floating around the schools. This can affect learning as they are at home building their immune system and staying away from getting other kids sick. It also can affect eating, because if they're sick and not feeling well, they're going to lose their appetite. Or if they're congested, it's hard to breathe and eat, so they might avoid eating. The internet and media have an impact even at this young age. Remember that kids are curious and they're intrigued by the things they see and the things that their friends do. So when I was growing up, I had a friend named Molly who I'd hang out with after school. I was probably around 9 or 10 years old, so still in elementary school. My friend's mom made the best pasta. I'd go home and tell my mom how delicious the spaghetti was and that she should make it, just like Molly's mom did. Finally, my mom called my friend's mom to see what she does that makes her spaghetti so delicious. My friend's mom laughed and said, "I put canned ragu on noodles." My mom, on the other hand, would make meat sauce and different types of noodles, but my friend's spaghetti was so much better and obviously so much easier. Just some noodles and a can of ragu. I remember how much I loved her spaghetti, but it was also because of the company I was in. So keep in mind that food choices in children are influenced by their friends. And we can't talk about food without talking about growth, because this is something that's big and important at this age. Growth during this time is slow and steady, since they haven't quite reached adolescence where the big growth spurt happens. Breakfast skipping is an issue and something to be aware of. Thankfully, the National School Lunch Program provides free or reduced price meals to children, and these meals must meet specific nutrient requirements. The breakfast program is also offered, which means many children eat 2 out of their 3 meals outside the home. So moving on to adolescence, which is a really fun age and what we commonly refer to as teenagers, these people are all about autonomy. A lot happens during this period. If you think about when you were an adolescent, or if you're a parent or have an adolescent in your home, you know a lot happens. Puberty being one of them, there's periods of rapid growth and their body is changing. And some adolescents embrace this, while others might struggle more with the changes that are happening to their body. Eating disorders can start during this stage of life. I've had a couple patients who developed eating disorders because they wanted to stop their bodies from changing. This age is also where validation and approval matter a lot. They want to be liked. They want to form connections. It's really important at this age. Also, they usually have a big growth spurt during adolescence that typically lasts around 18 to 24 months. This is when you'll often see kids grow several inches. They're hungry a lot. It doesn't mean they always make the best food choices, though, which is influenced by their peers and what others are eating, because, again, it's about fitting in and being like everybody else. So they do tend to eat less calcium and iron-rich foods. Actually, many nutrient-dense foods are often replaced with foods that are lacking in nutrients. When I worked in pediatrics, because remember, adolescence is part of pediatrics, many of my patients were eating Flaming Hot Cheetos, they were drinking Gatorade, and they were skipping breakfast and lunch. I'd also see kids walking around after school eating the same foods that my patients were eating. It was almost like I could write their dietary recall before they even told me. So kids eat what other kids are eating. And there's so many things happening during this stage, not just physically, but also psychological changes which affect them. And keep in mind that peer pressure is very real. As a dietitian coming from the other end, it's really important to try and meet adolescents where they're at. And also keep in mind that they're just as affected by disease as adults. They can develop obesity, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, and diabetes. So leading by example is really important. And making sure growth is monitored. It's not just for young children. Adolescents need to be monitored too. And the growth charts go up until 20 years of age. So growth should be monitored, trended, analyzed all the way through adulthood. When working with adolescents and providing education, one of the best ways to ensure understanding and to get them involved is to demonstrate and get them to participate with their hands. Little kids often want to do things themselves, especially young children who are just learning. But as children age and become adolescents, they tend to stand back a little bit more. So if you're teaching them a skill, or you want to make sure they can do what it is you're asking them to do or teaching them to do, return demonstration or getting them to show you is the best way for you to assess their true understanding of the concept you just taught them. I just mentioned it, but I want to reinforce that infants, children, and adolescents are all plotted on growth charts. So from birth until 20 years of age, we make sure that they're on the growth charts. This is how we monitor trends, and this is how we identify areas of concern, whether they're losing weight rapidly or they're gaining too much weight. The CDC growth charts are for children 2 to 20 years of age, and the World Health Organization, or WHO, growth charts are for children 0 to 24 months of age. So if you're interested in working in pediatrics, growth charts and assessing growth and trends is something to get comfortable with. And remember, this is how we look to see if there are concerns, whether we're concerned about rapid weight gain, rapid weight loss, any concerning trends, or if they're not growing. This is why growth charts are so important, because it kind of gives an idea. And just as important as growth charts are, it's only as good as the data being put into the growth chart. So making sure that the weights are taken accurately and the height is taken accurately gives us better data points for monitoring growth and looking at their trends. And sometimes we see that the growth isn't measured accurately, so that can throw things off a little bit. So just something to keep in mind when you're working in pediatrics, and that you understand why it's so important that we collect that data point, that it's accurate, and that it's put on these charts so that we can see the trends and what's really going on with their growth. So let's talk briefly about adults. Once people become adults, growth is no longer a concern or something that we need to keep track of. They've reached their max height. This stage is defined by maintenance and prevention of disease and aging. Physical activity and the amount of lean muscle mass will determine a person's metabolic rate. Most of the recommendations we've talked about in school and in general terms pertain to adults. Think about the sodium recommendations, the DRI for protein, and physical activity recommendations. All of these are for adults. The food label, for example, is based on a 2,000 calorie diet, which is closer to the amount of calories adults would need. So our goal when working with adults is on maintaining health and healthy weight in order to prevent disease and aging. If you're seeing adults and you're in the clinical setting or the outpatient setting, completing a nutrition-focused physical exam will help give you more information on how well the individual is doing and if there's any risk to their nutritional health. Moving on to geriatrics. Geriatrics is defined as anyone 65 and older. And this is the fastest growing age group in the United States. The U.S. Census Bureau has the following definitions for the elderly population. Young old is 65 to 74 years of age. Old is 75 to 84 years of age. And oldest old is 85 years and older. And then there's new old, which are those who are 90 years old and older. There's also centenarians, and those are individuals who are 100 years old and older. And centenarians are super fascinating, and there's a lot of interest in this population, particularly regarding the secret to making it to 100 years old. But more than just making it to 100, it's about being independent at 100 years old and still being able to live life. If you're interested in this, like I am, there's a lot of information on the Blue Zones. I've talked about this before, but the Blue Zones are where many people live to be 100 years old or older, and there's a lot more people in certain areas on the planet. So it's not random, it's really incredible. And the five Blue Zones are Icaria, Greece, Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, Okinawa, Japan, Sardinia, Italy, and Loma Linda, California. In these areas, there's people who live to be 100 years old and a lot more people. So it's not like one person, it's multiple people live to be 100 years old and also thriving. They're able to live their lives, they're able to walk and hang out with family, and be able to participate in all the things that make life so wonderful. Researchers of the Blue Zones have noticed some trends among these areas and why people in all these areas live to be 100 years old or older. Physical activity and moving the body is a natural part of life in these areas. So from tending the garden or the yard or walking to the market, moving is one of the secrets to living to 100 years old. So that's an incentive. If you haven't gone out for a walk and you haven't exercised, it's one of the things that helps you get to be 100 years old. Another thing they noticed in these areas is having a sense of purpose is huge. Also, eating largely plant-based diets and monitoring intake, not eating too much food, is one of the trends. And overeating or eating beyond satiety is just not seen in these Blue Zone areas. Stress management is huge, as well as connecting with community. They put family first, they choose social circles that help with their purpose, and they contribute to their well-being. Also, consuming alcohol in moderation. And while there's variety in these areas, because each place is different, these are the trends and these are the similar things amongst all of these Blue Zones. As people age, there's physiological changes that happen to hearing and eyesight, such as cataracts and mouth and teeth and the GI tract, such as increased risk of constipation since gut motility decreases with age. Also, there can be changes with the cardiovascular system and the kidneys. And keep in mind that calorie needs decrease, but protein needs remain the same, or they might even increase depending if they have any pressure injuries or other things going on. Something to keep in mind when working with the elderly is that they often lose their sense of thirst, so dehydration is a big concern in this population. Providing a set schedule or a reminder to drink water can help prevent dehydration. There's a food guide pyramid for the elderly. At the very top of the food guide pyramid, there's a flag that emphasizes calcium, vitamin D, and vitamin B12, because these nutrients are really important in the elderly population, and there's something that we need to keep an eye out for when working with geriatrics. So if the nutritional intake is poor, it can lead to malnutrition and it can lead to other comorbidities. Another thing to monitor in the elderly is their ability to perform ADLs, which are activities of daily living. These are things like using the toilet independently, bathing, eating and drinking, being able to get dressed on their own. I think of it as the things little kids are taught to do. Infants need to have everything done for them, and as they get older, they learn how to brush their teeth, to wash their body, how to eat and drink on their own, how to hold a cup, for example, and then potty training. They're taught to tie their shoes and put their shoes on the right foot. So for me, when I think of ADLs, I think about the things little kids learn to do that we don't even think about as adults. When people become older adults, making sure they're able to continue these ADLs is really important and something that we have to assess. If possible, observing the elderly cook for themselves and clean up after themselves gives you a good indication of where they're at. These things really matter. If they're not able to do their ADLs independently, giving them resources and support so someone can help them is an important part of the care plan. There's different long-term care options, and this is a personal decision. Some people want to go into an assisted living facility. My grandma never wanted to live with anyone. Neither did my great uncle, who was her brother. They loved where they were living. They thrive from the connections with friends, and they like to play games and dance with other residents. Other families, on the other hand, might choose to have their elderly loved ones live with them. This comes up a lot in the hospital setting, and sometimes placement is a challenge. It's very personal, and every family is different. Residents have so much wisdom and stories and life behind them. They really teach so much about life, and I never get tired learning from elderly people. As a dietitian working in a skilled nursing facility, though, this population often needs nutritional support. So from texture-modified diets because of poor dentition or chewing and swallowing issues, to potentially nutrition support in the form of tube feeding. Each person is different, their needs are different, but this is something that dietitians working with this population have to be aware of. There's also oral nutrition supplements that might be part of their nutritional care plan. But in the end, making sure they get enough nutrition is so essential for overall health. A couple more things to touch on that are really critical and important in geriatrics. Sarcopenia, which is the loss of lean body mass, affects the metabolic rate. It decreases their energy expenditure. So exercise and resistance training can help slow down muscle wasting. And keep in mind that fat mass increases in geriatrics. Another reason to be physically active and keep moving. And lastly, total body water decreases with age. I mentioned a decrease in the thirst mechanism in older adults, which is important to remember and pay attention to. Dehydration is a big concern, especially in the summer or hotter months. So this is why when we have heat waves, they often say to pay attention and take care of the elderly. A lot happens during this stage of life that can increase the risk of malnutrition. Fortunately, this is on the radar now. Making sure we as dietitians assess for the risk factors and that we provide appropriate nutrition intervention can help mitigate the risks and promote health and wellness. So malnutrition, really big, really important, and something that we have to look at. And keep in mind that there are screening tools to see and identify patients who are at increased risk of malnutrition. If you're interested and you want to learn more about that, I did an episode on nutrition screening tools. So go back and listen to that if you need a refresher. One of the things I love most about this profession is that you can specialize in any area of nutrition. There's dietitians who work with people across the lifespan, and others choose to specialize and focus on becoming experts in one particular age group. And the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics offers specialty certifications for pediatrics and geriatrics if you're interested and find yourself fascinated with one particular stage of life. So that's your rundown on developmental stages and feeding patterns across the lifespan. Keep going. You've got this. It feels like a lot when you're in it, and it is. But remember, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. You weren't built for easy. You're here to make a difference. You're here because you're supposed to be. You're needed in the RD community, and you're gonna do great things. And before you know it, this will all be behind you. But in the meantime, stay on top of your study game. There's no limits to achieving the success you so deeply desire. Until next time.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and leave a review. Share this episode on Instagram at JanaNicoleRD and help spread the word to other RDs to be. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time on the RD Exam Made Easy podcast. Bye for now.